the best thing about the particular story between Alsamira and Beatrice Joanna was a rehearsal that we had with Declan and Nick in Nancy, where I think we all realised that, I realised that Alsamira begins the play thinking that it's a Shakespearean tragedy, like Romeo and Juliet, and it's called Alsamira and Beatrice Joanna. And he hopes it won't end tragically. He hopes it'll be a fantastic love comedy, and they'll, you know, be happily married, and there'll be a dance. And as there always is. And what happens in The Changeling is that he realizes, there's the scene in which Beatrice Joanna has the idea to get the florist to murder her betrothed, Alonso de Piracuo. That is where the Alsamira, Beatrice, Joanna, sort of Romeo and Juliet story veers off the train tracks into something completely different. And Alsamira has no idea. And from that point onwards, he is kept out of the loop. And every time he sees the audience and talks to them, and every time he's on stage, he thinks that they know as much as he does. But in fact, they know everything and he knows nothing. And for most of the second half of the play, he's a pawn in the chess game that Beatrice Joanna and De Flores are playing. And then what happens at the end of the play, in the final scene, when Alsamira confronts Beatrice Joanna about what he's seen Beatrice Joanna and De Flores together, is that he realises that it hasn't been a play about him at all, and he realises that he's been kept completely out of the loop. And that is... that's his tragedy, that's his narcissism, that's his loss. Narcissism in the sense that he thinks that he's his own protagonist, but that actually he's been a supporting player in a much greater scheme of things. And what's grown along the tour is playing the potential for a Romeo and Juliet story at the beginning, and playing the realization that it was never going to be that at the end. And I think that's something that we didn't achieve necessarily to its greatest effect at the beginning of the show, at the beginning of the run, but something we've really worked on. It changes, every venue changes the show, which is the best thing about this tour. The Changeling moves from place to place every week, and we only do five performances in every venue, means that the demands of the space and the mechanics of your entrances and exits, and just the technicality of the show, have an effect on, because that's fresh and that's new, that has an effect on your performance. So it never feels like you're trotting out the same performance, because you're coming on from a different place, which is brilliant. And so we're performing it for 6 months, but you're not performing in the same place with the same. It never gets robotic or routine, because each theatre has its own personality which you adapt to, and that's been brilliant. When I first read the play, I thought that The Changeling had all the characteristics of a Jacobean tragedy, in that it's about visceral humanity and blood and sex and death, and that's what we come to associate with the Jacobean plays of this genre. But Declan was very keen on the first day to talk about how it's the much more obscure things and the deeper things that are in the play, like it's loneliness. Everybody is so lonely. Alsamira certainly ends up very much on his own. And loss, and lost love, and it's a play about wanting something or someone very, very hard. Each character wants something very deeply, and it's about trying to get what you want and what happens when you don't. Tragedy, basically. Declan and Nick never stop They never stop working. They're always changing things, or just reminding you of the same old things, which keep the stakes of any particular scene at their highest. So that you never, if you feel stuck, if you feel like you're getting stuck in something repetitive, or you just somehow you've lost something, they always come in and remind you of the basics, the absolutely simple things of the way they work, of Declan's method. It's so simple. He asks the most simple questions of you as an actor, to get all the important things like context and what there is to win in any given situation, what there is to lose in any given situation, and all of his stuff, which he describes in his very brilliant book. Just like that, yeah. So that has a huge effect. And also there's the thing of, it's something about being, I think a company of actors get closer together when they're on the road than they ever would in London, and that's only ever a strength. And that's the great thing about touring, is that the more you get to know people, the more familiar you become with them, and the deeper the relationship you have on stage. So that's hopefully something that is reflected now in On the Last Leg.
I can't really remember what the show was like when we began in Paris. The fact that when you work in film, when you walk into a room, they actually draw lines on the floor to tell you where to stand. And there is both a sense of freedom and a sense of fear to not having any lines drawn on the ground, to not knowing where anything should go. And it's amazing how quickly, as a human being, you try and make a pattern, and you try and do what Declan would call moving furniture into an empty room. We want to clutter things up and collect things and say, if I stand here and do this, then you do that. And every time Nick and Declan have come to visit us on the tour, they've basically brought a large... they've essentially brought a large removal van with them and moved all our furniture out. And that is why the play keeps on being refreshed, and why actors need to have someone like him coming in over a six-month period, because actors, like all human beings, get caught up in the wrong details. And you need someone to say, it's not whether it's left or right, it's the fact that there is no left and right anymore. But in mere terms of blocking, you know, where we used to be clinging to each other desperately, we're now 100 miles apart. And in one scene, if we can be 100 miles apart. And then there's the bizarre situation we had in Almagro, where I was used to running from the front of the stage with all my might to the back of the stage to get to the door. And I, on the Almagro stage, stood up and turned and ran smack into the door, which is about 2 feet behind me. And adapting to that much of a difference in space. It's not just a physical thing, it's an emotional change. Your contact with the audience, you can whisper to them, you can whisper to the other actors on stage. It becomes almost filmic. You're demonstrating much less with your body. It's actually much more confidential, the work. And for an actor, you know, I like to satisfy my need to act big in theatre, because I do a lot of film acting where you're never allowed to be big. And it's a difficult discipline for me to be small on stage, and it was very good for me. So how you're feeling every day changes it. And you know, while nobody wants to be unhappy or homesick or hungover or sick or desperate or lonely, I have to say it helps and changes the show. You're feeling something extreme. And extreme happiness helps as well. It changes it anyway. And one of the terrifying realizations is that, you know, we've got four or five more to go, and I just feel there's so much still I haven't scratched the surface of, and you realize that I have felt this much worse in the past, that I regret the shows that I spent cruising, and I don't think I've cruised much in this, but I do wish I had worked more and changed more and spent less time worrying about the trivial things. And I hope, it was my intention when I began this job for once in my life to do what I was told, and every time Declan has told me to do something, no matter how much my instincts or my stubbornness resisted him, I've tried to do it with all my heart, and I'm so glad that even while I was doing it, it felt wrong. The end result, the effect on the greater vision, made it worth it. And again, actors are so selfish, and you want to do something that you've thought of in bed that you think is very clever, and all Declan's direction contributes to the greater machine, and this ability to see yourself as a cog in a greater machine is one of the most important things in any play and in any company. But that Declan has the most extraordinary sense of.
It's very difficult difficult to define yourself from the outside. I find it very difficult to define who a character is from the outside, because you sort of, when you've lived with him for so long, you lose track of where he ends and you begin. That's a bit worrying, isn't it? I think the sort of major changes are changes in terms of language or dexterity. By language, I don't mean the sort of specific words, but the theatrical language, the shifting between, shifting between a side monologue and dialogue, or what we refer to as monologue and dialogue. The sort of turns on a sixpence become more and more easy to execute, and the language of the production and the theatrical language of the piece becomes more and more sort of integrated with the way the character is. But when you start looking at a character to Florence, you are very you're very aware of sort of the reputation that other people say he has. I remember when I started, everybody was saying, "Oh, how are you going to do the ugliness thing? How are you going to, what's the sort of, like Richard III having a hunchback? How are you going to do the hunchback? How are you going to do the lisp? Do you know what I mean?" And there's something which, and so you become a bit sort of obsessed by what other people think the character is, what the sort of the myth of the character is within the canon of, you know, British theatre or whatever. And that all that falls away in a lovely way. That's what I sort of mean by the character becoming, you and the edges between you and the character becoming more and more blurred. That I'm no longer really aware of externals of the character, of the problem of what should he look like, or he just is. I think also I hope got wittier throughout the process, which I think is important, that as an actor you always start off by doing the bad acting, which is playing the problem, playing the fact that I hate myself, or playing the fact that I'm sad, or whatever, and as you get more and more relaxed with the person, you play the solution instead. You play the way they solve the fact that they hate themselves, or the fact that they are sad, so that the problem becomes, you, as an audience, I hope, you see what the problem is by the way that the character's solving it, rather than because you're playing the fact that, so I hope that that's happened, and I hope that DeFloris's wit has developed as a solution to all of the sort of obvious psychological things that you can say about him, in a literary analysis of the text. That he's he enjoys himself in a more natural way now. He has a sort of glee about him, which I think I always wanted to find, but it was sort of hard to pin down. I had an interesting time, interesting for me, with sort of physically, that I found myself quite early on standing with my hands firmly clasped in front of me, which was incredibly useful as a sort of, physically it gave me the impression, firstly, of always, there was a slight tension in my arms, I was always pulling against the hands, and it sort of embodied the tension that he was feeling, and it also physically made me feel repressed in the way that he felt repressed. And Jane Gibson came along and told me to stop holding my hands in front of me, and I had a few performances which were really difficult because it had become so entrenched in who he was, the way he was physically, the way that sort of buttoned him up. And she kept saying that you can do that with the acting, you don't need to, you know, still needs to be he needs to have a grace about him, he needs to have a... And at the time I sort of just couldn't get it, and tried to find excuses and ways around it, blah blah blah. And I'm now delighted that I did sort of fight through that, because I've just found a way of, again, that's an example of not, of something which you put on as an external. It's an example of playing the problem, I suppose, that it's much more interesting, somebody who is forced to stand absolutely in a totally relaxed and sort of unpent-up way, but inside is completely knotted and self-hating. So that was a sort of, I mean, those kind of tiny things, the sort of things as an actor that obsess you and that can be completely imprisoning or completely liberating. And I think he now feels like he has a sort of something like the sort of grace that she was talking about, and the sort of wit that Declan talks about. And I remember Siobhan saying that, Siobhan Bratt, the casting director, saying that Declan had said to her that he wanted the florist who had a sort of beauty about him, which I don't think I understood at first at all, but I do begin to understand now that there is a sort of beauty in him. And I continue to bawl for England about the sort of the two sides of the narcissism of ugliness and beauty, but also the two sides of self-love and self-hate, that somebody who hates themselves that much actually completely adores themselves. Can't just, I mean, you know, as in all that the theatre at that time, the sort of the antithetical, a sense of the antithetical is incredibly important. And I think with him, the ugliness and beauty, I begin to understand sort of as a sort of ambiguity in his character. Not in a literal sense, in a completely sort of opaque, badly expressed, inarticulate.